This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Coulter, coming off Man City win in the Champions League this morning. So up and about, go Team Pep. With me this morning, we have the person that is firing up the podcast machine on her way to Horsham this weekend. This will be six seasons of Talking Split. Ratings will go up. Zoe Carr, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to get out to Horsham again.
Excellent.
Back in the car.
Yeah. I don't even think I know how to drive.
This could be a new little segment.
Do you remember where Horsham is?
Yeah.
And as you've already heard, the lady that went off the grid this weekend, Jenny Screen. Welcome, Jenny.
Nice to be with you guys.
It's the longest I've ever waited for a reply from Jenny on a text.
Yeah, she's normally pretty good on the reply.
Normally very sharp.
I know. I'm sorry. I did go off grid and I was in the bush and my had no range. I wasn't ignoring you, Rob.
No. That's okay. You wouldn't be the first or the last, in all honesty, in that space. So, coaches, we are back this week talking about selection trials. This is a chaotic time of year and obviously coming out of lockdown, VJBL starting up fairly soon, domestic basketball coming back. You guys will be in the selection space fairly soon as well for your SDP and everything that goes along with that. We're talking trials, how to do it, how what not to do, I suppose, is a really important part of that as well. But there is a mountain of work that goes into this time of year that goes on behind the scenes. So there's the whole getting on court, which everyone sees, and you can pick your teams from that, and we'll discuss that in a little bit. But there's a lot of things that go on off the court as well. So, Zoe, what are some of the things that you are mindful of before you even get on court for your trials?
Well, I suppose a lot of the coaches probably don't need to worry about this because it's handled by admin, but something we need to be mindful of is how many athletes are we actually going to have so we can make sure we have enough courts. If we don't have enough courts, then we have tons of athletes sitting out doing nothing and it becomes really difficult to judge their abilities or, you know, what they can and can't do. So that's obviously point number one for me is making sure we have enough courts so the most amount of athletes can be active for longer throughout the whole session. Obviously, you need to make sure that, you know, you've got your session plan set up. You need to have, if you're the coach or you're dealing with coaches as a DOC, you need to have a good understanding of either what you want for your teams. So if you're looking for to be a development club and you want, you know, you're looking long-term athlete development, then you need to structure your trials to suit that. If you're a win now club and you want to, you know, you want VJL1, VJL2 titles, then you structure your, I don't agree with that, but you structure your trials to suit that. So, you know, about how you select your athletes, which athletes you're looking for, you know, what sort of offensive structures are you going to run? Like if you're a long term, you should be trialing through motion principles. If you're win now, you're probably going to put your offense in and let them scrimmage. But the biggest thing for me with trials, and I'll admit I did it early, very early, you don't need 1-on-0 ball handling, like maybe as a quick little warm-up. The amount of times I've seen athletes in their 1-on-0 zigzags or whatever they're doing, and they look fantastic, and then you get them into gameplay and there's pressure on and it's terrible, don't waste your time with it. So if it is a just quick little warm-up, fine, but big blocks of non-competitive drills, I don't think there's time for it, especially in club land where you don't have, like at camps for us, we have all day. So we've got that little bit more time, but in club land you might have an hour and a half. So maximise your time as best you can and get them competing to the things that you want to see.
Yep. Jenny, what about you? What are some of the things that you were considering before you even get on court with the trials?
Very similar to Zoe, obviously numbers, allowing the kids the best opportunity to be seen, so enough time. Obviously that's really difficult right now in this COVID space. We do not have time, but luckily we have enough eyes in the space that we work in that we have a good knowledge of the kids already, and then we work with DOCs. And then, yeah, I can't, you know, I'd be just reiterating what Zoe said predominantly, but there's not that much different. It becoming deaf when you come to the next question of selections, you know, I can get a bit deeper there. But other than that, it's just making sure you've got also with your trials enough set of, when you're doing selections, also having the eyes there with you, because there's so many kids and you can see one kid do one amazing thing and that's it for the training and that, or this the trial, and that means that they could make the team, but in actual fact they've done nothing else. And it's not until someone else sees or says, hang on a minute, what else has Joe Bloggs done that you don't realize and stuff. So we can attach to, you know, what we see first and what we see last very quickly when it comes to selections. But apart from that, I think Zoe hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, excellent. So, I mean, a list of players, obviously you need to know how many courts. Your split of top age, bottom age really matters, because in a lot of cases they will trial with two age groups in together. So knowing, am I looking at under 15 kid against under 16 kids, and that doesn't always go well, is that going to be an issue for you? How many spots are up for grabs? So obviously in the VJBL world, you're dealing with 10 athletes in most cases you can pick. In your world, very different. You guys don't really have quotas to pick to in that space. You're just picking to whenever the talent drops off, so to speak. So you do need to be mindful in that space as well. Are you going to coach on the day, or are you going to have other people come in and coach and you observe? Like, those kinds of things, difficult to deal with?
Yeah, I don't think you should be coaching. I think you should be a voice at the start and, you know, set the tone and the expectations of the trial, but then you have to hand it over to someone you trust to pretty much run the training plan that you've designed, I believe, if you have the luxury of having coaches within your organizations to be able to do that for you, because then that allows you to step back, because when you're in it, you don't see the entirety of what's going on. When you step back, it allows you to just, you know, let go of a little bit of control so that you can actually do what your job is to do, and that is to be there to select a team or a squad.
So would you still intervene? Like, if you do have someone else running your session, at any stage would you intervene and still talk to athletes and those kinds of things?
I would. I don't know about Zoe. And again, it depends on what kind of trial it is. If it's for a state team or a high level performing team, then probably not, unless I didn't like what I was seeing from the actual outlay of the drill or the concept or whatever. But no, I think you want to, I would refrain as much as I can to create a little bit of pressure and tension for these kids, because that's what you want, because that's what you're selecting them for. Can they perform under pressure? But if it's for domestic and all those type of things, then I think there's a little bit more learning that goes involved depending on the age group. So it's a bit of to and froing depending on, you know, context, shall we say.
Yeah, makes sense. Depth chart. Like, we'd be very naive if we walked into a selection trial and didn't have an understanding of probably who the best, let's say, 7 or 8 kids are, and know that they're probably going to get picked anyway. Like, that's, I think any coach could walk in, see 30 kids, pick the best 7 and 8. And how do you deal with those 7, 8? Do you still coach them on the day? Would you leave them alone and say, we're going to trial you against, you know, some of the other kids that we've got on as a fringe? Like, how would you deal with those kids?
So for me, it's, they get treated like everybody else. I know, again, it's very different from what Jenny and I do versus what happens in clubs and associations. So in clubs and associations, I would start everybody on even keel and have everybody, you know, just sort of line them up, tallest to shortest, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, send them off that way. And that's effectively your teams. And then as the, it might sound a little harsh, but as the trial goes on, start moving kids from court to where you sort of see them fit in your team selection. So you can start to see, you know, you've got your best, let's say your best kid is a point guard. So you might move a big over to see how that big works with that point guard, or whether that big makes them better or worse or those sort of things, and start shifting around to see who can play with what and start to get a bit of an idea. Because the worst thing I remember in Clubland is waiting for the first team to be picked to then have to wait to see what athletes, you know, you've got available if you've got the second team to be able to pick yours, and then the third team, the fourth. And so the poor person sitting that's, you know, put their hand up to coach the fives, for instance, is waiting an eternity to see which kids they get to pick from. So the quicker you can get that done, and like I said, it sounds a bit harsh, sort of spreading them out, and then you know, they do get an understanding of which court is the first team court. But that'll make that process quicker, and your coaches that are doing the job that are the hardest to find, which are in your, you know, threes to fives sort of category, well, thank you for that. For me, mine, I spread them all out. So if I've got athletes I know are locks, or they might even be in VMPP because we make them trial anyway, they will go into different teams and we'll make them play each other. So then get to see them, you know, I'll make a four match up on a point guard, you know, those sort of things. So it, for them, it becomes positionless, and they have to go at each other and kind of take each other out. And then, yeah, the rest. So then we can also see the rest play as well.
Yep. And it's not easy to do in that space as well, because you are really mindful of kids' feelings. Like, well, they don't want to feel like, oh, I'm on the bad court here, and, yeah, and this is divvial. But unfortunately, when it gets to selections, you do have to pick.
Yep.
So there's the whole, and we all see it, the top of the program stands out, the bottom of the program stands out, and that middle in between where you can make a second through a fourth team, and there's really, you know, splitting hairs,
yeah,
between what gets you.
And I think that's the art of a coach, right? Anyone can come into a stadium and pick the top, probably the best five or six or seven. It's that next cusp or tier that, you know, is really art of coaching. Like, what am I seeing? What am I looking for? What are these kids showing me? Do they just need this to go a little bit further, or they're not up to it? Like, that, I think that's what makes, yeah, I get fascinated by that next tier, because ultimately that, I think that will make or break your team, not the top six, to be honest.
Yeah, and with any team, you're going to spend, whether it's a Friday night team, a state team, an Oz team, you're going to spend the majority of your discussion on player 8, 9 and 10. You know, like you said, your core's generally pretty set, and all that time's going to be on those athletes. So, you know, giving those, because there's probably about 5 or 6 that probably could, any of 3 of them could fit into that spot. So you need to spend that time seeing which combinations work, who works well with who has chemistry, who doesn't, who has the ability to either go further, who's, you know,
a douche.
Bad.
You know, seriously.
Yeah.
I won't pick a kid with bad attitude.
Yep.
It's just a recipe for disaster to create cracks and issues that you don't want there. I look for that more than anything. What is the attitude? What's the body language of these kids? For me, that's a huge selector for me. Just for me though.
Yep.
It may not be for someone else, but for me, bad attitude, bad body language.
What's bad attitude? What is bad attitude and bad body language for you in that space? Because for some kids, they just might have some nervous mannerisms, and you don't want to confuse the two as well.
Yeah, that laughing, when I get in trouble kind of mannerism, like, I'm in trouble, but I'm going to laugh. No, for me, it's more, what do they do after a mistake? What is their body language like? Are they a go-getter after a mistake, or is it head down, whoa, I'm the victim, feel sorry for myself? Do they lay blame after a mistake or a turnover? Because turnovers are normally sometimes individual, but there's a two-way action normally when it comes to passing potentially. Do they take ownership of their turnovers or their skill or something that goes wrong? Are they teamy? You know, are they coming off the bench or subbing in and out, giving high fives? Are they communicating? And obviously communication at different ages varies, and there's a lot of introverted kids these days, but you don't have to be verbal to be a great communicator. So, you know, they're the things that I look for, just those slight tendencies that you can see. And without being harsh to parents, you know, you see it infiltrate their child. So their body language from their parents on the sideline, normally you'll see it in their child on the court.
I'll add another
one. I'm not stereotyping, guys. So if the parents listening, don't, you know, chew me out here.
At Jenny Screen on Twitter.
No, I'll add another one to that. Do they adjust? You know, so if you give them an instruction, and it doesn't matter if they're not good at it, when they make the adjustment, do they at least try and make the adjustment? One of my pet peeves, I might be alone, but one of my pet peeves is giving an instruction to an athlete who simply refuses to change. You know, like if you can't do it, that's okay. And I think a lot of coaches do a great job of creating the environment to allow errors and to allow growth. If you're in one of those environments and you still refuse to change, that's a red flag for me, and probably line through the name.
So obviously coaches' meetings happen prior to trials. You know, you're going over what does the plan look like, making sure that everyone understands the drills. Like that's a really important part. We've all seen coaches jump on court. You have the meeting beforehand. Yeah, got it, no worries at all. Then they get on court and they're like, what's this drill? So making sure in that coach's meeting beforehand, everyone is across that. It's the worst feeling in the world when you have to ask that question because you've skimmed over it. You thought, yeah, okay, I've got this covered. And then you're on and you don't know. Like that's a real scary one.
It's like not following the recipe of baking a cake and then you're like, oh, that just didn't.
Why do I have curry?
Did not rise. The souffle did not rise how I thought it would.
Yeah, salt and sugar are very easily substituted for each other, it turns out.
I think that's a two-way street though because, yeah, the assumption sometimes of the lead coach is that they know it. And then sometimes the ego of the younger coach is, I got it. I don't want to show you. I don't know what I'm understanding because you might judge me rather than just asking. Like I always try and encourage, there's no such thing as a dumb question. It's the question you don't ask that then flows into what you're saying there, Rob. So I think, yeah, the time and the detail and then explaining to them the what, like why, what is my team or whoever the head coach is, what do I want out of this? What is the team looking like or what kind of characteristics are we looking for when we're going to the selections? Because it may not be the best kids that make it. It's what the makeup is of what you're trying to achieve.
And that's with our, like, for example, with our camps. So I'll stand up or Coops will stand up and we'll talk about what we want for the camp. We'll actually run the drill, set up the drill, and then send them off to their baskets with their coaches. So then we can wander around and see who's doing what. But then we find that, like, I think I would have found that helpful back in Clubland if the DOC did that. So you can stay on track. And because there is one thing, I must admit, there is one thing looking at it and thinking you understand it. And then there's quite another when you step on floor and actually have to do it. So to sort of, I suppose, stick up for the coaches a little bit, I think more DOCs or head coaches or whoever it is that's running the trial need to get on court to show what they want and then they can step off and watch and see what they want from their athletes or help out with selections on lower teams or whatever that might be. Because then, yeah, you get exactly what you want. You can also hold coaches to more of an account because they've seen it and make any adjustments that you need to make.
And one of the most important roles, I think, too, is the Patrick Hunt term, whipcracker. Like you almost need someone that is on the clock, that is just buzzing around doing stuff, making sure it runs to time, run the detail. Someone that needs ice, no worries, they go and get it. It's, you're not taking coaches away from the courts to do that. You need someone that is just there. And a lot of coaches see that clock thing as a bit of a slight. It's like,
It's so true because you lose time. Like you think, oh, I've allocated 12 minutes to this. No worries, it's fine. But then by the time you demo it, you come in, you demo from maybe four courts, then you go back, that's already 4 or 5 minutes. Then they've got to get used to it, set up. Then the coach, it goes. And before you know it, you're like, oh my God, we've lost time. We've got to catch up. And then you chase and tail. I couldn't agree with you more there, Robbie, in terms of that person that's just on the nose, regardless of what's going on, unless the DOC or the head coach wants a bit more at this certain drill, then that's fine. But yeah, you need that person. Yep. Next one.
So during trials, would you guys meet or do you try and stay away from the other coaches and not discuss it so that there's no, you know, Zoe says, I really like this kid. Jenny's like, yeah, I don't. And all of a sudden you talk and it's like, yeah, okay, now I do like them. Or would you do that more at the end of a selection trial?
We meet at lunch. So we've got a different setup to Metro where it's actually pretty lucky. So we obviously train, have a break. So at each, finish. At each break, how it generally goes is I say, okay, everybody, I have number 1, 5, 7, 11, 12, da 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 da. Go through that. Does anyone have any different? And then if someone puts their hand up and says, yes, I have so-and-so, then it's plead your case. They tell me why or why not. I just may not have seen that athlete. I might have just happened to be on another court or whatever it might be. So I'll then be able to mark that athlete and make sure in the next session I can come out and try and get eyes on them. The great thing about the coaches I have the pleasure to work with is they understand that, you know, I want to hear from them, I want their opinions, but ultimately I have to make the decision at the end of the day in conjunction with the state coach because of the way we're structured. But, you know, they do a great job of fighting for athletes and things, but they also accept when we say, look, that she might be, you know, a good player now. Does she have the ability to be a long-term player? You know, does she have the ability to get to WNBL or beyond? And then we can have that conversation. So that's generally how we run it.
What about you, Jenny?
Yeah, we're pretty similar. It depends. SDP to state is a bit different. They're not, you know, aligned in any way. We try not to make them that. So probably I take more ownership in the SDP selections than I would for state. So, but the same premises apply. The only thing we add now, and this has been a benefit, and this came from Jared Hillier, was that we take photo, like we do the numbers, but we also take photos of the kids, headshots. So then we come to talk at our breaks, lunch, whatever, and you go, oh, number two, and you're like, oh, I've got 87 kids on court. I cannot remember that kid for the life of me. But now we have a little headshot and we go through them in numerical order as we go down the page of all the athletes or whoever's in attendance. And that just triggers your memory. You're like, oh, yep, I remember that kid. Yes, no, whatever. And we continue on. With state, I try and play a bit more devil's advocate. I stay out of the way because ultimately it's up to the coaches that we have hired to have their teams, and I just come in occasionally at breaks and just throw questions, make them maybe think a little bit laterally, or pose different things to, you know, get them to question their own philosophies and ideas on their selections without trying to, because at the end of the day there's that bias, right? Subjective, subconscious, conscious, whatever, and there's a lot of them, and I don't want to persuade in any way, especially on a state level, that they potentially don't want. So, it's a bit different, but same, but similar.
Yeah, and it's harder, again, at the VJBL level where a director of coaching may come in and say, you need to pick this kid. They are the long-term future of this program, but they're gangly, they're unco, they fall over every 30 seconds. And it's a really hard sell to tell the coach, you need to pick this kid and play them and develop them over the course of this year, even though it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, well, that conversation needs to happen well before trials. So that needs to be, you know, and I know there'll be, if there are coaches in Clubland listening to this, they'll be saying, we're just happy to have coaches. We can't afford to do anything to sort of push them away. And I completely understand that. What needs to happen though is have that conversation of, if you are indeed a long-term club, these are the athletes that we expect to pick, and to the type of athlete, sorry, that we expect to pick and have involved in our higher teams. If there's pushback, then that's an opportunity to help grow them as a coach. And if you're going to say you're going to do that, you have to follow through. So it's one thing to say you have to pick this kid. They're the long-term future of the club. And then the coach is like, well, I don't know how to coach them. And then you go, oh, well, I'll see you at trials next year. Like that's a sure way to get the coach to just say, no, I'm not coming back. But if you can guide them through and help them, show them different ways, maybe turn up and sit on their bench and help them out with where and when to get them in and all that sort of stuff, now it's like, okay, well, I might not like it, but at least you're going to support me with it. And the big one, obviously, if you lose games because of it, you can't get angry at the coach. It's just, that's not on.
It's going to be a really difficult selection process for a lot of clubs out there at the moment because, look, we're recording this on the 4th. I've seen some clubs advertising selection trials for VJBL on the 5th. These kids haven't done anything for months, and the first thing we're going to throw them back into is a competitive environment where they almost have to fight for their right
under
to make
pressure,
a team,
yeah,
like where they don't know how to balance themselves or anything like that. So what would go into a session plan to at least try and alleviate some of those problems of kids underperforming because they're underdone, and they're underdone through absolutely no fault of their own? What can you put into a session plan, Jenny?
I think you can have more breaks. just to give the kids time to compute, not so physically but also mentally as well. You got to remember the last best part of 2 years they've been in front of a computer screen, so their learning has changed, their way that they absorb things has potentially changed. So I think given that, just allowing a bit more time in your demonstration so that they can absorb it a little bit more, allowing more drink breaks for those that, you know, the authoritarians that think water is for the weak, you know, just allowing them that opportunity. And even if they don't want a drink break, just getting them together on their basket and maybe having a little break that way, I think just allows them time to catch up, and then hopefully we're just not breaking them before they're back. That's that's the biggest thing for me. And then just making sure your depth, most of these kids, except for your under 12s and under 14s potentially, you should have a pretty, if you're doing your job, you should have a pretty good understanding as to where they're at. So making sure your depth charts are on point as best you can be to help you facilitate, I guess, the selection period as well, and then the training plan in terms of where you want kids.
Yeah, I think something I would probably do in this situation in particular, well, the first thing would be I wouldn't have trials on the 5th. I'd wait till the next week. Yeah. That would be number one. But if, you know, we don't know the reasons why. It might be a court space issue, you know, might be a size or volume of athletes issue. So, you know, it is hard to judge. Be curious, Rob, not judgmental.
Thanks.
But something I would – it was a callback to last week's podcast.
No, I understand. I felt like you were having a crack at me.
No. But something I'd probably do, like Jenny said, a big thing that they've done now is spend a lot of time on screens and absorbing information that way, whether it be through basketball or school. So something I'd probably do is if you're planning to put some type of offensive structure or motion principles or whatever it might be, I'd put it in video form and send it out. And so to all of the athletes that are registered, and send it out to all of them. So when they get there, it's not the first time they see it. They don't feel, you know, there's a chance, hopefully, they're not feeling as overwhelmed when they see it. Helps them absorb it a bit quicker and can kind of help your session move a little bit. But if they know it already, then there's already step one of, hey, I'm actually, I can do this kind of thing. And you're boosting a little bit of confidence just by putting a little video together. You know, you could go through and say, okay, this is what the trial's going to be. We're going to do this to this to this to this. So they see it all. And then, yeah, again, they're not feeling as worried or as overwhelmed walking in.
And it may go the other way. They may get that and go, damn, I'm not up to this.
Yeah.
Like that's the other fear. So it's a really fine line to tread. So when you look at your content for your training sessions, more breaks, absolutely. Because we are on such a short turnaround between team selections and into grading, I would strongly recommend making sure that you have some of your offensive structures in place during those trials. Remembering, everyone's going to get zoned in grading. Like, it's coming like a freight train. Like, so there needs to be something that will work against zone and man in there. So making sure you do have something. The static drills, I would suggest, is something you want to get away from. And that's what you were talking about before, Zoe, like the one-on-zero ball handling. Probably not going to be all that helpful. The old alley drill, where you start in the full court, two dribbles, crossover, and the defense plays the token defense, and it's like, hey, but when you get to half court, then you can go live. And it's like, yeah, that's not really doing it for me. So something that's at least game relative, the use of small-sided games is going to be really helpful for a lot of coaches to be able to assess the players as to where they're going. One thing you do have to be mindful of, and it sort of ties into a little bit what you were saying before, Jenny, with the breaks, you do need to be mindful of how many kids are active at each time. Do you have a drill where you potentially have, and it tends to happen, under 14 boys is probably the most tried out age group in Victoria across the board, and every club will have huge numbers there. You have to be really mindful of, if you're doing like the 11-man fast break drill, how many people are in those lines on the sidelines? Like, if you've got 20 kids waiting to check in that only get a check in every now and again, you never get to evaluate those kids. So you have to be really mindful about what you're putting in, how many breaks, how many courts, those kinds of things as well. So that's difficult to do, but you have to plan for it.
Yeah, if you're doing a drill like the 11-man fast break drill and you've got heaps of athletes sitting out to the side, that also helps build that pressure of, you know, I only get one possession every 4 to 5 minutes to show what I can do. So now I've got to make sure I do everything really well. And then if it doesn't go right, then they've got to wait a massive amount of time before they can do it again. And, you know, so again, it just all builds and makes it that, I mean, we love to put them under pressure, but maybe not this year.
We just had to be a little mindful there.
Yeah.
I think it's the best way. And I remember one of the years I was a state assistant coach when we got down to, I think it was around about that 20 to 30 mark, and we were just sort of going through what the session plan was going to look like. One of the coaches said, we just need to play more 3-on-3 at this training session. And it's like, what the hell are we doing that for? Like, it's 5-on-5 game. Like, why are we thinking this? And there is no better way to find out which kids can make decisions than when they have more touches, more space, more skill set points. And it's like, yeah, that's actually pretty relevant. The use of small-sided games. And it might be a case of you start with a drift, a diag, and a point. And ball will start in the diag, and you start from a different alignment. But you can still get some really interesting action where it might be they pass up to the point and then they go on down screen for the drift. That can be a way of just finding out, well, actually, we want to know who can use a pin down, or, you know, who will refuse the pin down and go back door on that because they've read where the defense is going. So trying to find out ways to teach both sides of it, but also test the IQ of the kids. So a lot of coaches, and I'm 100% an absolute guilty party in this space, we go into training sessions and we put in offense and we put in some rules and some structure, but we don't even talk about the defensive side of things. And I can play my player development hat here and say, but that's because I want to test the player's IQ to see what they do defensively, and I don't want to give them too many rules. It's like, well, actually, give them some rules and find out who can follow through with that and who is just trying to work it out as they go along.
Rule number one, stay in front.
Yeah, that helps for all defensive players. So you do need to be mindful too as to test that balance of, well, do I need to have them in 5-on-5 games where they're potentially just going to be getting up and down frantically and they're going to be spent within, honestly, 7 possessions when they get back on court. Yeah. Like, it's going to be early doors. Or do you go down the path of, well, look, rather than have, you know, 10 players up and down constantly, I can have 3-on-3-on-3 in the half court where I don't need to see them necessarily gut running, but now I can test their decision making, their skill sets, those kinds of things. So there are ways to do it where you can still maximize the use of your tools around you, but you're not killing the kids as they're getting back on court as well. Not easy to do. So we do need to make sure that we're aware of both sides of the ball. What notes would you be taking during a trial, Jenny? So I've seen it a lot of different ways, and, you know, there's been coaches I've walked past that have got red hair, green shoes. It's like, well, that's not a good note. Like, what are you doing? That's not going to help you other than identifying the kid. What would you
do?
That was pre-photo days.
I used to, yeah, pre-photo, that's me. I remember kids by their shoes, to be honest.
Well, this is dangerous.
I know. I don't know why. It's just a thing. But
you need a Foot Locker sponsor because they're all going.
But I learned a good thing I learned from Dean Kinsman is writing shorthand. So now I have a key or a table of keys, if you will, that give me what I need or the letters that I need that are referring to. So if it's a body type thing, it would be, you know, BW or white, WB, wide body, or T for tall, L for long, and those type of things. I'd normally also have N for need, P for proficient, and then that's like proficient, and then you write what that is at. It could be a skill, it could be shooting. So PS or PSK, obviously skill, right hand, don't move. So I try and go shorthand as much as possible rather than scribbling 5 pages of notes on one kid, because the more you have your head down, the less you see, which is the really big key there. So I think if you can get a table, if you're doing a selection and it's almost like sports code, right? It's how you need to do it. So when you present a PowerPoint, you want it the way that it will flow for you. It's the same with having like a table of keys or a table of letters, just to quickly write down shorthand what you need.
Yep. So I always use basic. I think mine was. So it was like body, athleticism, skill set, IQ, competitiveness. And I just have that across the top with just an arrow up or down or just a line through. So if it was really good, arrow up. If it was lacking a little bit, arrow down. And that was a really easy key for me at the end of the day to go through and say, well, okay, we've got 5 arrows down on this kid, so they're probably not going to be at this level. And that might simply mean they move down a court. They're not on the main court for the next session or whatever the case may be too. But that was how I used to do it. What did you do, Zoe?
At the risk of being very different to everybody. I write as little as possible. Now, I have the luxury of not working with the same numbers as Jenny does. Excuse me. So when we come into camp, a lot of the athletes, I'm well across already, have a good idea on who they are, and I'll more go in with notes of what I want to see from certain athletes. So then I can manipulate the session or manipulate matchups or whatever it might be to be able to see that, to be able to then pick them. And then in the breaks, I'll write my notes then of what I've seen. But like I said, very easy to do when I don't have anywhere near the amount of kids turn up that Jenny has over a massive amount of days. Like we're one day effectively and then that's it. So, you know, it's as well as all of my basket coaches will take little notes and things like that. I'm really lucky that our hub leads in all the regions as well have a really good hold of what their athletes are like in their region. This year's going to be a bit different with the under 15 age group because I haven't had a chance to see them at anything. So that'll be a bit of a challenge. I'll have to go in with a bit more of a plan there. But normally, yeah, I just go in with what I want to see out of certain athletes, just like those fringe athletes that we were talking about, where they could go either way to give them the best chance to be selected. Because ultimately, if any parents are listening, no coach wants to cut. Like, it's not fun. We don't enjoy it, but it has to be done. So I want to give all my athletes the best chance to be selected, and then the rest is up to them.
And it's tough. Like, if you ever talk to Jenny on like a Thursday afternoon after she's done 4 days of camps and you say, hey, what was that kid like on the Tuesday? You just get an evil look. Like, it is just, you've got to be kidding me. I've seen 400 kids in the last, you know, however many days. Like, it just, it drains you. It wipes you because you're trying to remember everyone and everything they've done, and it's bloody hard to do.
It is. It's really hard. I've gotten better, and, you know, as much as I want to praise Ash because, you know, I've divorced him now, he was really good early on for me. He knew the lay of the land, both the male and female on the metro side. And it's also having conversations. If you don't know kids well enough, especially in our space, Zoe and mine, pick up the phone or email your DOCs or speak to their coaches at their associations that actually work with them week in, week out, especially those kids you're on the cusp. You're like, oh, I just don't know, haven't seen enough. And then another thing I do, you talk about taking notes, is I keep my notes. Yes, nerd, I know. And I have the database, but it builds over time. And it speaks to you, Zoe, in terms of I know these kids. So if they're coming in under 12s or 14s, they're normally in the pathway until they're top age 18s. And it's interesting to see how your notes may or may not change over that period of time. Are they getting better in certain pillars and aspects of what we're looking for? Are they not? Are they just stagnating? And it's really intriguing to see how the kids progress when you see it there. Rather than just taking notes and throwing them in the bin after every trial, I always like to reflect on past trials as well to get my insight on the kids.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because if you've had them, you know, at a camp, especially like from your point of view, Jenny, where you're doing camps all the way through, and, you know, you've had them in, say, top age 14s, and the feedback or the notes have been, you know, doesn't dribble with their left hand. And then then you get to, you know, 16s, doesn't dribble with their left hand. 18s, and it's like, okay, maybe this one's not adjusting, this one's not working, let's give another athlete a go. And you, like, with that information, that's really helpful.
So when selecting teams, are you guys picking with a number system in mind? So as in the traditional 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is what they are, or are you going down the path of nah, talented kid, we're just picking them and we're going to make it work in that space? Jenny, what are you doing?
My role's different. So in the state SDP landscape, no, it's just what is our philosophy? What kind of kid are we wanting in this program that fit our what we've discussed as HPCs? And that's what that's selected on. It's got nothing to do with positions. We could probably have 100 point guards if we wanted to, especially on the boys' side, because there's not many bigs coming through. So SDP is different. It's more a platform to allow kids to develop skill acquisition in the sport of basketball from a holistic point of view, not to win championships where there's no games. On the flip side, with state, you know, the head coaches are looking more positional, obviously because they have the KPI of going to the AJC and trying to win gold or a coloured medal. So it changes. But for me, at SDP Land, it's just whatever kid fits the criteria that we need and we feel that they deserve an opportunity.
Yep. What about you, Zoe?
Well, same as Jenny for SDP, given we're not picking teams as such for that, it's more for development. So whoever is good enough makes that or has the potential makes that. For state teams, I used to be, depending upon which nationals it is. So 16s, you can get away, I think, without taking bigs, because bigs at 16s haven't really worked their stuff out yet. Like, I don't remember the last time, and someone will definitely, remind you me on this, but where there was a ready-made five at under 16 nationals, like
Lauren Jackson.
Well,
Lauren,
okay. I don't know. She's older than me. Good. She's older than me. I didn't see her at nationals. But in saying that, how long ago was that? And that's the last one, you know, and she was pretty special, right? So exactly. So 16s nationals, you can get, if your best players are not 6'5", I think you can get away without them. 18s is obviously a different ball game. You need to be aware of what the other states have. So who are the next? And for us, we're very mindful of what Metro have, because whenever we go to a nationals, Metro's our bar that we're looking to go to. So we're mindful of who we think that they would pick as well, to make sure. And that doesn't mean, you know, if Metro take massive players, you know, the big kid's going to miss out. A good guard's going to miss out to take a big kid. But if there's those fringe, like I was talking about before, the 7, 8, 9, 10 or 8, 9, 10, then we start to look positions and who can guard what and who and all that sort of stuff. In Clubland, I would love to see just the 8 best athletes picked and then 2 spots for long-term athletes and coach them. It's really easy to pick them and then go, oh, this is too hard. Pick them and coach them. Let them play. Let them make mistakes. Let them improve. Because as much as it might be difficult, those long-term athletes are obviously the ones with the most chance of progressing and becoming something. And then, you know, you get to add that to your list of athletes that you've worked with. So if that's what can drive a coach to take a long-term athlete, please do so. But, so it depends on – for me, it depends on what you're picking for.
Yeah, the conundrum of the actuals versus the futures, right?
Yeah.
You know, and what's your KPI? Is it to win? Is it to develop? It's so hard, especially in the pathway, because we all mature and develop at different rates, and you know the man child isn't going to wear the green and gold, but he'll probably win you a gold at a nationals at under 16s. It's a tough one. It really is. I hate it. I hate selections. You know I don't like selections, Zoe. I get very emotional with them. The empath in me, I'm like, oh my god. But you know that it's part of the process, and it builds the resilience for them as well if they aren't lucky enough.
Yeah, and you know, selections is just one little snapshot of where they're at. Like it's. I mean, Josh Giddey's a great example.
Yeah,
you know, didn't make a state team until top age under 18s, and having a reasonable start to his NBA career at this point. You know, so yeah. Selections doesn't necessarily mean always the here and now. Sometimes missing out is actually a really good thing, and we do need to be mindful too, especially in the VJBL space, and it leads into the state team space as well. The kid that's born on the 1st of January versus the kid that's born on the 31st of December are in the same age group.
Yeah.
And there is a year's worth of growing and learning and developing involved in that. So we do need to be really mindful in that space too, that just because a kid looks a little bit weak and fragile, that might just mean that they were not born at the start of the year. They were born at the back end of the year, and they tend to be the long-term athletes that we have to really look at, because they will eventually catch up.
Yeah, birthdays are huge for me. We'll always say to my coaches before any selection, there's a couple of rules. One, check the birthday. like if they are, you know, just like you're saying, just okay, but they're November, December, or even October through December babies, we need to have another discussion about them. And two, don't make your reasoning for picking an athlete that they're just such a good kid or there's just something about them. If you can't tell me exactly what that something is, it doesn't exist to me. So you need to be able to articulate exactly what it is as to why this athlete should be in, because when feedback comes in from athletes that have missed out, I'm not going to be able to turn around to a parent and say, well, your kid just didn't have that something about them. So it's got to be specific. And that can be hard sometimes. Sometimes, you know, there's just this kid that you go, oh, they've just got it. Well, what is it? What do they do well? Explain to me exactly what that is, because then that helps, one, as a coach with your talent ID, but two, then when it does come time, if you're in clubland, for instance, and you have to give feedback as to why not to a DOC or whatever it may, well, that might be. I know any DOC with their grain of salt will say, I need specifics.
Yep. And that is, and it's hard because we've all heard that mantra, if you don't win in team selection, but you can lose. Yeah. So coaches are really mindful of that. That does not apply at the VJBL level. Like it's, especially this next 12 months, any coach that is being judged on wins and losses, that's not fair. Like that's not fair from anyone. So really be really mindful here. Pick the long-term kids. Look after the kids that want to come back into the sport. That is a vital part of this.
Yeah, reward the kids that are putting in the effort or have put in the effort when the adversity has been there, which is now, which is not being on court and not having someone there to hold their hand, you know. I just wish we changed the psyche of what we're trying to achieve at VJBL land. I think it would change the landscape. And not just VJBL, across the board, just removing winning out of the psyche and focusing on the process. And if you focus there, I just believe winning takes care of itself. I honestly do. But we just go to the end point so often and we miss the process. And in the process, we miss the kids.
And that's like hit the nail on the head. I instruct my state team coaches, yes, go and try and win. Of course, you know, you've picked a state team and you're off to nationals. You're not going to go and just sort of labor through it and just whatever. You're going to go and you're going to try and win. But my KPI as to whether you're successful or not in your campaign is, did you showcase the athletes, especially the athletes? Every team that goes to nationals pretty much has an athlete that could go on. Did you showcase that athlete? Did you put them in positions to turn some heads at the next level? You know, where you've got, you know, Veely and Co. From the COE and beyond. Did you put them in positions for people to recognize what we've seen while we've been able to work with them regularly? All that sort of stuff. So whilst, you know, medals are great and all those sort of things, and I suppose it's probably easier sitting in my seat than it is sitting in your seat, Jenny, saying something like that. But winning is great, absolutely. But if we're going to talk what our roles are as HPCs and head of SDP and NPP, VNPP, our roles are actually to move our athletes forward and to move them on rather than just across, which, you know, like what I mean by that is move them up the chain. Get them to the COE, get them to a good college, get them recognised by, you know, WNBL and beyond, you know, get them to Oz camps, all that sort of stuff.
But I think that's the same premise at VJBL land. Like I would love a coach to hold their hat on how many kids go on to represent either the state or the country that they've coached, not how many championships they've won at VJBL level at under 14s. But then none of them have progressed on. So that to me is the win now rather than the process. So I admire the coach that can forego the now to then go, I coached that kid and we developed that kid to the best of his ability.
Yeah, and it's not easy. It's having been in clubland, it's certainly not easy.
Yeah, see, I haven't. Yeah. So I need to hear and just say, blah, 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 do this.
like, but, like, you know, you've got, you know, parents who want to see their kids win, because winning at the end of the game, like winning is, they say, winning is the best band-aid. Like everything could be going wrong in your team, but you could be winning.
Memories, but some of my best memories that I recall, I don't know about you, Zoe, or you, but some of my best memories playing weren't when we won. Like I think of AJCs, and obviously I didn't play for Victoria, so we didn't win very often. But like it wasn't about the winning. It was, I don't know, the memories, the team, the culture. Like it was so much more than that. It wasn't standing on the podium at the end. That was just the byproduct of everything else. I don't know. Yeah. That's me though.
But in Clubland though, you've got so many other things around you. Like when you're at Nationals, you're in your own little world. You know, like your team, you're there together. Anything could happen and it doesn't matter, you know, so because you're in that world. But when you're in Clubland, you know, you've got administrations who want you to win, because if you're seen as a winning club, more athletes might then come to the club
so
and make you more successful.
We need to change administration.
Oh, everything. There are parents that want to see their athletes win. Kids want to win, like because they see it as – you know, win is good, lose is bad, and all that sort of stuff. We need to change, and I don't know how we do it, but we need to change the mindset of everybody involved, so then we can hold those coaches accountable for having too much of a win now mentality. Because right now they're like, hang on, I'm just a volunteer coach and I'm copping this because I'm trying to play the long game, and I'm copping it. Eventually anybody would crack and change that or stop coaching. So there are some outside influences I think we need to address before we start, you know, going on to coaches all the time.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with coaches that want to try and win, because everyone's competitive. They, of course. Like as soon as you get there, you want to try and win that game to your best ability, but it is. And it's more probably the career coaches, I suppose, that are looking to further their career by winning games. And it's not that. Like it is not like winning does not develop you as a coach, like that, and that's the reality of it. Like it's how many times have you guys gone into a state team interview process and looked and go, "Geez, they've won a lot." Like, it doesn't happen. they're not interested in who wins VJBL titles. What is being interested in is how do you develop athletes.
Yeah,
like that's the real key, and that's something that we can't lose sight of at trials. So it is a bit of a blank slate because we haven't seen these kids on court for 2 years. So we do need to be mindful that there is some bias involved, that we know who a few of them are. But the real test for you as a coach coming up, can you select a team that is going to be successful on and off the floor? And success does not necessarily get defined by the win and the loss. Success will be they still like each other at the end of the season. Like they have developed, they have improved, they want to turn up. Like that's the real test at the moment. Do the kids love the sport enough to want to go regardless of anything else going on in their outside world?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day too, I know like coaching is all about the athletes, it's athlete focus, but you also need to be able to make sure that by the end of it all, you still enjoy it as well. And to be honest, I've always enjoyed developing athletes and making them better and seeing them move on than winning. Although I really hate losing, but I prefer that development far more. And I think what you'll tend to see is if you can stick with it through grading, through the start of the season, you know, through the Australia Day tournament, all that sort of stuff, if you can stick through it, you might lose games early. But then you start to see the switch, you start to see the development pay off, and you go from a lot of early losses to teams that are potentially not doing things the right way to beating those teams by the end of the year. And you get to, you know, see the fruits of your work. And with the way VJBL is structured in terms of finals and things, you can still make finals. So I would implore any coach when they're heading into trials and looking to select their teams, play the long game. Because whilst it could hurt early, it's so much more rewarding by the end of it.
Absolutely.
So, coaches, good luck.
Yeah, this is going to be really good.
Yes, guys, Do all of that. It's really simple.
No, it is difficult. And look, if you need a hand with trials or selection and like session plans and those sorts of things, you're more than welcome to reach out to me, coaches, and I'm happy to flick on some of my session plans. There's a great article on the BA website that Lono put up last week as well that's got a Phil Brown webinar about running training sessions in there. great resources for coaches to have as well. So would absolutely recommend that coaches to put a little bit of work in here, because it will make your selection process go easier and end with a happier team, which is what we're really after here.
Can I just say to any coaches that, you know, are heading into their trials, like Jenny and I both have, and Coops and Ash, not Ash, Darren, holy moly, I've got to get better at that. Can you
it's
edit
all right,
that out?
Same hair colour, just different sizes. You know,
both from down that way.
Yeah.
But we've all got trials coming up. You're more than welcome to come in and see, you know, how we do things, how we talk about things, the things we look for, all that sort of stuff. Obviously, you're more than welcome into my selection meetings. You won't be allowed to speak, but you'll be allowed to be there. So just reach out to any of all four of us. We'll give you all our dates and times and venues and things, and we would love to see you there and love to help you in any way we can.
And I think just two more points from me before we, you know, wrap it up, but you're never going to get it right.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter how hard you try as a coach, there's going to be one selection you get wrong or a couple selections you get wrong, or it just doesn't work, and that's okay. That's, you know, it's like a kid screwing up and having to put their shoes back on and go again. It's the same in coaching. You're never going to get it right. And so cut yourself some slack sometimes, because I think, you know, we take the weight of the world on our shoulders. And my other point I've forgotten, so I'm going to hand it back to you guys.
Excellent. Jenny will throw it
up. It was good, though. Oh, it was good.
I have no doubt. Like, once you're in what it is, let us know. We'll put it out with the podcast in the notes. So, coaches, those of you that are on this weekend, good luck. Those of you that kick off next weekend, still good luck. We hope it goes very well for you all. Best of luck with your coaching, and we'll catch you guys next week on the podcast. Look, tune in, enjoy the tribe on iTunes.